stiffly.
I... There was... the surgeon. Remember I told you about the surgeon?
I softened then, just a little because I recognized the struggle in Tomas's voice, and I realized that I was about to hear a new kind of story from him. A story he didn't know how to tell. I stared at him, and in that moment I had to force myself to focus on the knowledge that I had known this man for our entire lives. He was a good man. This might not be a good story, but the man telling it to me was essentially good. If what he had said just now was true, there would be a rationale for it,
even if in that moment I couldn't even begin to imagine what it was. But I did trust him, at least enough to give him the chance to explain. I reached for his hand, and he looked at me in surprise.
It's okay, Tomas, I said gently. Just tell me. I'm not going anywhere.
I started to walk again, his hand tightly in mine. He fell into step beside me, drew in a deep breath, and then he released it in a rush with a tumble of words.
I fought with the Polish army in Warsaw until they had overpowered us. We put up a hell of a fight, but we were no match for them. Not in the end. The Nazis captured me and a group of my friends from the college, and we were given a choice. Join the Wehrmacht, or they'd kill our families and put us into prison. He said they had intelligence on us all, and they knew where our families were. And I thought if I did what they asked, could save my father and Emilia, and maybe even you, darling Alina. Because what if they already knew we were engaged? I felt I had no choice. I didn't know what else to do. So I joined the Wehrmacht.
He spat the word out bitterly.
I wore the filthy uniform, and I did everything I was instructed to.
I remembered my brothers telling me that students from Warsaw had been conscripted to the Wehrmacht, and how I'd scoffed at them, because I'd been so certain that Tomas would never comply with such an order. But one thing I knew all too well about Tomas was how deep the love he had for his family was, how deep his love for me was. They had found the only leverage that would have convinced him to betray his country.
Did you kill people?
I asked unevenly.
There are worse things than murder, Alina, he whispered. I betrayed our countrymen. And one day when Poland is whole, you can bet there will be an accounting for cowards like me. Especially me. I went to Warsaw to learn to heal, and instead, I enforced their ideology. They liked me because I spoke some German from summers on vacation. They liked me because I was strong and fast, and because... He broke off altogether now, and I heard the sob he tried to muffle. The commander said I had a way about me that put people at ease. They assigned my unit to moving families to the Jewish area. The little children were so scared, and their mothers were so frightened. But I told them it was going to be okay. They just had to do what we told them to do, and they'd be okay. But it wasn't okay, not even in the early days, because there wasn't enough room or food. And it was just a way to corral them all into one place to make it easier to hurt them. They built a wall around that ghetto. It is hell on earth, and there is no escaping it. And I marched those children in there, and I promised them that they'd be okay.
He could no longer muffle the sobs, and I could no longer stand to hear this story without holding him. I stopped, turned to him, and threw my arms around his waist. I pressed my face against his chest, and I listened to the beat of his heart, the thumps coming faster and harder as the memories and his shame surfaced. I struggled in that moment, horror and revulsion at his actions, but also growing understanding. Because it finally made sense, the darkness I glimpsed in him from time to time,
It was rooted in mortification and regret of the deepest kind. He had made decisions that betrayed the very values that made Tomasz Laski the man he was. He sank to the ground at one point, but I followed him, and then pushed him until he was resting against a tree trunk. Tomasz still couldn't look at me, so I straddled his lap and I cupped his face in my hands.
"Tell me everything, my love," I whispered.
The tears rolled down his face into his beard, and he raised his eyes to the forest canopy above us.
"Your father would kill me if he knew what I'd done."
"Perhaps not if he knew why, Tomasz."
"Your father is a good man. He would have resisted."
"He won't judge you, Tomasz. And neither do I."
"The Poles will kill me one day if the Nazis don't get me first. Good men like your father will find me and kill me for what I've done."
I shook my head fiercely, then I kissed him, hard, the best thing I could think to do to stop such talk. He swallowed, then met my gaze again.
"Tomasz," I said firmly, "tell me the rest."
He drew in a shuddering breath, then sighed.
"One day I was patrolling the ghetto, and I saw him. Saul Weiss."
"Your surgeon friend?"
"Yes. He and his wife, Eva, had been taken there too. They'd been dragged from a nice apartment near the hospital to a pathetic room in the ghetto they had to share with two other families. I pretended I didn't recognize him at first, because I was so ashamed to be a part of what was happening to him. I looked away from him and I walked some more, and then I glanced back. And you know what he did? He smiled at me. Kindly, Alina. He smiled at me."
I could barely understand the words leaving Tomasz's mouth because he was weeping again. I started to cry too, and I bent and kissed the tears away from his cheeks, then nuzzled my nose against his.
"I'm still here, my love," I whispered. "Keep talking to me."
"But he should have hated me. Only he refused to debase himself with hatred. We had shared a history, a friendship, and even in those circumstances he extended warmth to me. Saul Weiss had lost everything because of people like me. People who didn't have the courage to take a stand. And still, he chose to smile. That was the day that I broke inside. And I knew I couldn't take it anymore."
"How did you get out of Warsaw?"
"The sewers," he said.
Then he pressed his forehead against mine and paused for a moment, collecting himself.
"We waded through the sewer. Me, Saul, and his wife, Eva."
"You let them escape with you?"
"No."
He laughed bitterly, then sadness crept over him.
"You still think I am the hero of this story, Alina. But I am trying to tell you that I'm the villain. They let me escape with them. I went back to apologize to Saul. I dragged him into an empty shop front because I had to play the part. But once we were alone, it was me who wept. And a few days later, when it was time to go, he trusted me enough to invite me to come with them. They had used the last of their money to pay a guide to lead them through the sewers. Honestly, I thought it was a suicide mission. That's actually why I agreed to go. I had no thoughts of what I'd do if we made it, because it didn't even seem a possibility. And death seemed far better than staying there in that uniform and dying of the rot inside. No one was more surprised than me when we climbed into daylight in the outskirts of Warsaw. Saul and Eva had no plan from there, so we started on foot. We lived under bridges and in barns for months on the way back here."
"But how? Did you come the whole way on foot? It's hundreds of miles, Tomasz. It's..."
"Close to impossible, right?"
he said sadly. "You see my point, then?" We had so many close calls, I kept thinking that any time soon it would be all over. But luck or God or fate was on our side, because we eventually encountered a sympathetic farmer who connected us to the Zygota network. It is an underground council to help the Jews, supported by the government in exile. We would never have been able to cross over from the general government area without their help.
We fell into a bruised silence for a while. Eventually, I shifted onto the ground beside him and wrapped my arms around his waist, then rested my head against his chest. I let my mind conjure images of all that he'd told me, even the parts that I didn't want to imagine, because they were a part of Tomas now, and I wanted to know and understand all of him. After a while, he cleared his throat.
You need to understand, Alina.
Saul and Eva saved my life, and I have made it my mission to help them. They are hidden nearby, and until I can repay them, I will do whatever I can to help them hide.
You steal food for them?
Yes, if I can find it. I capture birds sometimes, sometimes squirrels. I steal from farmers when I can. Only because I know the Nazis take it all anyway, so I'm really stealing from them. I've taken eggs from your own hen yard, but only because you have so many chickens I thought they wouldn't be missed. Only when I was truly desperate.
I felt like I had to say the words aloud, just to put a name to it all. It took me another few minutes to find the courage to say the words, and even then, I whispered them.
You are aiding Jews in hiding, yes?
I have three groups of friends in hiding in the miles around your farm, including Saul and Eva. Many others are hidden in houses in the township, and from time to time I help them too. But others working with Zygota usually bring them food. Sneaking round in the town is incredibly dangerous.
Everything you have just said is incredibly dangerous, I exclaimed, drawing away from him. Don't you understand? The Nazis have made a decree that if you assist a Jewish person with so much as a glass of water, they will kill you and your whole family. How could you not even tell me about this? I am your family, Tomas, but so is Amelia. You could have just gone into hiding alone without them, and that would have been so much less dangerous.
Saul and Eva have a newborn,
Tomas interrupted me, his expression suddenly hard. I blinked at him. A baby?
Yes. Eva gave birth a few weeks ago, just after we arrived back here. Tikva can't eat anything but her mother's milk, and Eva can't make milk unless I bring her food. Am I to let the newborn starve, Alina?
He held my gaze, the bite of sheer frustration shortening his words.
Saul is a good man, a far better man than me. But he's Jewish, so the invaders would have him starve like an animal. Or worse, lock him up in a camp and work him to death. And that baby is the most beautiful little doll you have ever seen. Oh, but she was born to Jewish parents, so I suppose she deserves to die too. Would you pull the trigger at her temple then?
Don't say these things, I protested fiercely. I was crying, overwhelmed and scared. But Tomas was undeterred by my tears.
But that is what you are saying when you tell me I should have left them behind.
A crippling sadness crossed his face, and his gaze pleaded with me for understanding.
This is why I wasn't going to let you know I was here. I was going to stay in hiding and find ways to help you, but I was never going to show my face to you. I know that would have been cruel. But it would have been safer for you. I would choose our love over anything else. But I won't choose you over what is right, not this time. I wouldn't be the man you deserve if I didn't help these people.
He stopped abruptly and ran his hand through his hair, frustration etched on his face.
Monsters shouldn't feel a great love like we have, should they? I have to prove that I am not a monster. Please don't ask me to stop. please.
The risks Tomas was taking were unacceptable. But everything about life in those days was unacceptable, because every time we accepted our lot, things always became even worse. I had a sudden, startling burst of clarity. We had to fight. Even if not with guns and weapons, with the sheer strength of our spirit, and for every single one of us, resistance meant something different. For me, resistance would mean doing whatever it was Tomas needed me to do, even if it meant certain death for us both. I stared that thought down bravely, confused by my own courage. If anything, Tomas's revelation made me wonder, not if he was the person I thought he was, but if I was the person I thought I was. Even knowing for sure that my relationship with him was, in essence, a death sentence, I wasn't deterred at all. I had come to see myself over the years exactly as others expected me to be. Tiny in stature, pretty and delicate, too feminine to be of much use around the farm, spoiled and lazy and immature, and maybe even just a little foolish. Certainly not brave. Certainly not heroic or noble myself. If I really was that girl, the thought of risking my life for Tomas would have petrified me. I'd have run a million miles in the other direction. But in that moment, all I wanted to do was to find a way to make him safe, a way to give him peace, a way to help his friends. The love I felt for him was so big that it eclipsed my fears, and it shouldered his burdens as my own. Our love was now a mirror, and within it I could see myself clearly for the very first time. I didn't see a spoiled, foolish girl with a crush on her school friend. I saw a woman who was feeling a very selfless, very adult kind of love. "I won't ask you to stop," I said, and he raised his eyes to me. "In fact, I am going to find a way to help you." He shook his head immediately. "Not a chance, Alina." "Don't," I said, firmly but softly. "Don't you dare tell me it's too dangerous. Loving you is dangerous now, and I couldn't stop that even if I tried. Your calling is my calling. We do this together. Because what do you always say to me?"
"We are meant to be together," he whispered, but his gaze was serious. "Even so, I can't let you take any more risk than you already are, Alina."
"You don't let me do anything, Tomas," I said gently, and he gave me a sad, reluctant smile. "I don't know how much help I can be, but I have to try. Even if I can just get a little more food for this mother and her precious newborn, but now..." I drew in a deep breath and glanced back toward the fields. I hadn't heard Mama calling, but surely she had been, and she was probably about to come looking for me. "I've been gone far too long, and I have to go." I brushed my lips against his. Tomas Szlaski was exhausted, physically and emotionally wrecked. But there was a new depth of honesty between us, an intimacy unlike anything we'd experienced before, born in the deepest kind of vulnerability. He'd let me see him, every part of him, even his shame. And in return, I could offer only understanding and acceptance. It would be years before I'd appreciate how profound that moment was, what a relief it must have been to him. At the time, I was doing only what the love I had for him compelled me to do. I was acting purely on instinct.
"I love you," he said.
I kissed him one last time and closed my eyes to breathe him in.
"I love you too, Tomas, and you are no monster. Not to me," I said. Then I looked up at him and the tears surged again.
"You are a hero, my love. I know you don't feel like one yet, but one day you'll see."
When I came down from the hill that day, Mama looked at me, frowning.
You have been crying, she said.
What?
I feigned ignorance.
No, perhaps I am getting a cold.
A cold? She repeated, sighing, then almost to herself. Alina thinks she is getting a cold.
I knew she didn't believe me, but I didn't have time to worry about that. I was already thinking about dinner and how much of it I could hide for Tomas and his friends.
Chapter 16. Alina. The summer of 1941 was fading toward fall, and by then, that sporadic tower of smoke that I'd so feared in the earlier days of the war was becoming a permanent landmark. The acrid scent that had so disturbed me when it first appeared became as familiar as the scent of chicken dung in the fields. Flecks of odd gray ash appeared on my clothing and in my hair, and settled on the fields like a fine snow when there was no wind. I learned to ignore it. I had to ignore it, because there was simply no escaping it. Tomas was still living in the woods without shelter, and he had very little bulk to his clothing, so much so that I was trying to figure out if I could covertly sneak some of my brother's clothes to him before the weather cooled further. I knew he was already cold. Some mornings I'd go to greet him, only to find he was dozing in a hollow trunk because he needed to curl up in the night now, and his lips would be blue and his whole body trembling.
You are friends with Nadia Novak, right?
I asked him one day. He stiffened.
I know Nadia, yes.
Can you not stay with her now that it's a bit cooler? Or even hide with some of your Jewish friends?
No, I can't stay with Nadia. It is far too risky to even attempt it. As for my friends, it is too hard to get in and out of their hiding places. I need to be able to leave each night so I can get more food for us all.
I believed him when he said he would find a way, but I worried about how far he was going to take this quest to help his friends. I now understood that the guilt he bore from his decisions in Warsaw drove his every thought, and I was scared how far that would take him. He'd already taken on one suicide mission and survived. How long would it be before he did so again? I was thinking about that one morning as I walked to meet with him, so lost in thought that I was carelessly unaware of my surroundings. I heard movement ahead of me and raised my gaze. I was looking straight into the eyes of a soldier who was standing just a few feet away. I was so startled, I screamed without a single thought. The high-pitched, piercing sound echoed all through the woods, and the soldier swung his rifle from his shoulder to raise it toward my face.
Please, I croaked, shaking my head. Please, no.
He flung rapid-fire German at me, but I couldn't make sense of it, and I stared at him blankly. I raised my hands over my head in case that's what he'd asked. But he gave me an impatient look and, to my surprise, said in Polish,
What are you doing here?
Alina, Mama called from behind me, sounding oddly exasperated. Would you slow down, child?
Mama, I croaked. I tried to turn to face her, to warn her not to approach. But I couldn't tear my eyes away from the soldier. And in the end, it didn't matter. It was far too late to warn her anyway. I felt her draw near to me, and she greeted the soldier.
Good morning, she said.
Her tone was casual and warm, as if there was nothing at all out of the ordinary about the scene she'd just come across. I shot her an incredulous glance.
What are you doing in these woods, old lady?
The soldier demanded, swinging the rifle from me to Mama, then back.
We are walking the path. Going to visit my daughter's home in the town, Mama said easily.
Then she added with convincing concern,
Are you looking for someone?
From farther up the hill, I saw another soldier approaching, and behind him, another. As I scanned the hill around me, I saw six of them, arranged in formation, all eyes fixed on me and Mama in that moment. My stomach dropped into my toes, and it took everything within me to stop myself from looking up. What if Tomas was right above us? What if he'd fallen asleep in the open again?
I had to assume he was without identification. And besides, they would take one look at him and know he was hiding from something. He was nothing more than a bag of skin and bones, held together by rags.
There are Jews hiding in this district, the soldier announced. We are sweeping the woods, looking for fugitives.
Here? Mama said, sounding slightly incredulous. She laughed, freely and quite loudly.
Who would hide in this tiny patch of woods? You'll find them in a heartbeat if there's anyone here.
She pointed back vaguely toward our house.
We live just a few hundred feet away. Trust me when I say there is no one in these woods. I would know if there was.
Documents?
The soldier demanded. And just when I thought I'd die from the fear, Mama calmly reached into her shirt, then stepped forward and handed him our identity papers. He scanned these, then nodded curtly, tossed the papers vaguely back in Mama's direction, and motioned with his rifle that we should continue along the path. Mama returned the paperwork to her undershirt, slipped her hand through my elbow, and led me past the soldiers toward the top of the hill. I tried to turn my head back toward them to see what was happening, but she shook me hard and muttered a fierce,
"Eyes forward, Alina."
Several Nazi trucks were parked at the bottom of the hill on the Shebinya side, in the space where the grass grew long but the trees had been cleared to make way for houses. Mama and I walked right past those empty trucks, my arm still caught in the death grip of her elbow. We walked the remaining blocks to Truda's house in a stiff and horrible silence. When Truda swung the door open, I finally burst into tears.
"Get her some tea," Mama sighed.
Then she pinned me with a stare.
"Alina, my girl, I have been more than patient with you, but it's high time you told me the truth."
Amelia came bounding down the hallway, delight in her voice as she called,
"Alina, you have come to my house for a change."
Her little face fell as she saw my tears.
"Oh no, what is it?"
"Everything is fine," I told her. I tried to fix a smile on my face, but I couldn't hold back the sobs, and Truda glared at me and hastily sent Amelia outside to play. Mama and I sat side by side at Truda's kitchen table. Truda made us tea, then went outside to Amelia, and, all the while, I sobbed and avoided my mama's gaze. I was in such a panic I couldn't untangle my thoughts. If I'd gone to the hill 2 minutes earlier, we might have been sitting together when the soldiers came. And I knew we could never risk such encounters again, even if the soldiers hadn't found Tomas in their sweep. After a minute or two, when my sobs weren't even beginning to slow down, Mama sighed heavily.
"Stop fussing, Alina. There is no need for such drama."
"It was the fright,"
I said unconvincingly. Mama rolled her eyes at me.
"I have figured out your secret," she said.
Her announcement made an already awful situation unexpectedly complicated. Because did she really know my secret? Or did she just think she knew? What if she thought my secret was something else? I also didn't want to anger her, because my mother was a formidable woman, and not someone I wanted to cross. I pondered all of this as quickly as I could, and then I looked back to my tea.
"I don't know what you mean, Mama,"
I whispered as innocently as I could manage, given adrenaline had once again flooded my system and my heart was thundering all over again. But then she smacked me on the back of the head and muttered something under her breath that sounded suspiciously like, "I'm not an idiot."
"When did he come back?" she asked flatly.
My heart was thumping so hard against my chest that I was sure she could hear it.
"Alina, Tomas is back, and he is in hiding. Am I right?" "Prayer for the country at war," she scoffed.
I stared at her in shock, but then she chuckled.
"Even if we hadn't already suspected, we'd have soon figured it out when you insisted on going to the hill when it was raining."
Her gaze softened just a little, and she murmured,
"I was 18 and in love, too, once upon a time."
Why didn't you tell me you knew?
Well, to be honest, I was scared too. I wasn't sure why you or he would ever think it was a good idea to hide him from us. So I was waiting for you to tell me what was going on. In the meantime, I decided I would stay close by in the field in case I heard signs of trouble. And it is fortunate for you that I did, given what happened today.
I felt nauseous then, and as I lifted the tea to my mouth, my hands shook a little. Mama and I waited in silence for a while. Then she asked me,
"You must tell me now, Alina. Why is he hiding?"
I looked at her in alarm.
"I don't know," I lied.
She raised her eyebrows at me and saw all the way through me with one of her stares. I felt my face flush and I started to sweat.
"I don't."
"Is it the resistance?" she asked, and she leaned back in her chair and added casually, "Or has he tried to help some of those in hiding?"
I didn't say a word, but she must have read the truth on my face. She grunted, and it sounded a lot like approval. I looked at her in surprise.
"Mama?"
"What?"
"If... I'm not saying he is, but if he was hiding some Jewish friends..."
"I would still be confused as to why you didn't tell me this earlier."
"But maybe he was trying to protect me."
"Then he is not nearly as smart as I thought he was. Because if he was, he would know that any contact with you means danger for us all. But that Father and I would understand."
Hope, warm and surprising, blossomed in my chest.
"You understand?" I choked.
"Do you remember when Felipe wanted to join the resistance?" Mama asked me.
She so rarely talked about her lost sons, and I was a little taken aback.
"I do."
"And we all discouraged him. We all thought it was safer for him to just put his head down. Remember?"
"Yes, Mama."
"Well, we were wrong, Alina. He is dead anyway. And maybe if we had stood up and fought..."
Her voice broke, and she cleared her throat, then exhaled.
"We have tried so hard to keep you all safe. We have done everything we could to protect you. But that wasn't nearly enough. And now I am so sorry we didn't instead find some way to resist. Perhaps we could have made a difference. If not for Felipe, then for someone else. Our passivity makes us guilty, Alina. Father and I have been talking for some time about how we might rectify that, but the right opportunity had not presented itself. Do his friends have shelter?"
"His friends do, but he doesn't."
"Then what will he do when the winter comes?"
I looked at her and she raised her eyebrows at me.
"It's not far off, Alina. He cannot live in the woods once the snow comes. Tell me you have a plan."
"He hides in the trees. Sometimes he hides behind logs. But he's been falling asleep during the day and..."
I choked on another sob.
"He says he will cope. But I am so scared."
"Do you understand how much trouble he is in?"
"I do."
"I need to know that you understand how much trouble you are in, Alina. You are helping him. By half measures, perhaps, if all you are doing is kissing in the woods and sneaking him some crumbs. But it's still helping him. If he is aiding Jews in hiding, then so are you. And that is punishable by your death."
Her gaze was sharp and focused right on my face. I grabbed her forearm and squeezed, hard. She had to understand. She just had to know how much I loved him. She just had to know that I would take any risk to help him.
"Mama, it's Tomas. He's all alone in the world except for me. Even if it's dangerous, I could never abandon him."
I wiped at my eyes with my spare hand.
Besides, Mama, he is helping a family. A new baby will die if we don't help. How can I choose my life over that infant?
Mama stared at me. She surveyed my face and the tears on my cheeks. Then she nodded, as if she was satisfied.
You can't, Mama said. And neither can I. Let me help.
There was no sign of the soldiers' trucks when we returned to climb the hill, and the woods were still and quiet again. I scanned the treetops desperately, but found no sign of Tomas, either. I tried to convince myself that he'd stayed in the trees, or hidden in a hollow log and survived the sweep. But I had no way of knowing what had happened.
Could I call out for him, do you think?
I asked Mama. She shook her head.
I have something to show you. Come back to the house for a few hours, and you can search for him later.
Father greeted us at the door to the house, concern in his gaze.
Where have you been all of this time?
Mama pushed past him. Then she announced,
Alina needs that help we discussed. Watch the road and the woods. There have been soldiers about.
Father nodded curtly, then positioned himself at the window in the kitchen. Mama walked across the room and pushed our table back, off the heavy rug it rested upon. She lifted the rug, and I gasped, because attached to the bottom of the rug was a hatch. As Mama folded the rug over itself, she opened a roughshod doorway in our floor and revealed the entrance to a space below our house.
Mama!
I choked.
Hush, she said impatiently. It is what it is.
It was a second cellar, apparently a smaller storage space than the large one we had beneath the barn. This was a cellar that I'd never known about, in all my years living in that very house. I suppose I'd have noticed some unevenness in the floor if I'd walked over the rug. But I never had, because for as long as I could remember, the table had been in that very spot, right atop it. I walked to the edge to stare down into the space. There was a ladder, and while I was curious about what could be down there, the darkness seemed utterly suffocating, and I had no intention of climbing down to find out. Mama turned back to the kitchen and started the little oil lantern that was kept on the bench there, which she passed to me. I held it silently as she climbed down the ladder. Then she reached up, indicating for me to pass it to her.
Come, she said.
But...
She waved the light around herself to show me that the space was larger than it first appeared, and her gaze grew impatient.
Alina! The darkness still frightens you. Death at the hands of Nazis for helping your outlaw boyfriend barely makes you blink. But climbing down a ladder makes you tremble. What nonsense, child.
So I followed her down the ladder, descending into the darkness. The air down there seemed thick, even with the latch open, even with the lantern on. I wasn't sure I could survive 2 minutes in that place. But as soon as my feet touched the floor... I saw the food. There were dozens of jars of preserves and a stockpile of potatoes, plus several sacks of flour and sugar. A basket of eggs rested on the floor. It was more food than the three of us would eat in months at the rate we'd been dipping into it. Dozens and dozens of morsels hidden for our use, every single one of which would guarantee death to my parents if the Nazis found this space.
How did you hide this from us?
I asked her breathlessly.
We started stockpiling long before the war, at the first hint of trouble in the papers. We moved everything we had into this space the day the invaders killed the mayor and Alexei, and ever since we've been adding to it when we could, just in case things got worse. We only ever come down here in the middle of the night when we're sure you're asleep, she said.
Then she laughed a little.
This is how we caught you praying through your window all of those months ago. Father was waiting to put some eggs down and to bring up a little more jam. That's when he heard you talking.
She tilted her head at me.
You were talking to Tomas that night, yes?
I nodded, sighing. He had only just returned then. I digested this, then looked around again. I glanced at Mama again, uncertainly.
Why didn't you ever tell me about this?
It is the responsibility of parents to provide for their children, and we happen to have a way to do that, she said simply. You didn't need to know. It wasn't as though we hid the cellar on purpose. In the early years, we didn't tell you this space was here, because we knew you children would make mischief if you knew of it. And we never intended it to be used this way. It was luck, not strategy. Simply a hangover from back before your grandfather built the bigger cellar with the new barn.
Mama rested her hand on my shoulder very gently.
Perhaps this can be of use to Tomas. There is no heat, but it never gets as cold down here. We can furnish him with this lantern. We can't spare much oil, mind, but perhaps enough for when it's necessary. And I have been saving the food strictly until it must be used. But with the boys gone, and it being so hard to get supplies over to Truda and Emilia now, just don't think we can use it all in time. To see food waste in such hard times is the real crime.
She paused, then she said with a shrug,
It will please Father and I greatly if Tomas can distribute this food to his Jewish friends. We have been looking for a way to help.
Mama,
I whispered,
they would kill you if they found this.
Well, Alina, she said matter-of-factly, there is a good chance if they find Tomas and learn that you have supported him, they will kill you too. We all take the risks we can handle in war.
What does Father know?
I asked, glancing nervously toward the hatch.
He knows the same as I do.
Tomas served with the Wehrmacht, I blurted. In Warsaw. Does that make any difference to you?
Mama blinked at me, then she sighed.
A fine young Polish man like Tomasz Laski would never work with those bastards unless he had no choice. Am I correct?
You are?
I whispered.
Then no. It will make no difference.
And Father will let Tomas hide in here?
He lets you visit with him alone in the woods each day, so this isn't too much different,
Mama said wryly. I felt the flush creep up my cheeks and she laughed softly.
Why do you think I follow you? It's not just the soldiers you could get yourself in trouble with, child.
When can Tomas come?
Wait another hour or two, then go find him and tell him to come tonight when darkness falls.
Chapter 17 Alina. I waited almost 2 hours, then I walked toward the woods as calmly as I could. My thoughts were racing. I was still trying to wrap my mind around the reality that my parents knew and that Tomas could soon be living under our roof. When I reached the top of the hill, I saw him slip down from a treetop to rush toward me.
I saw them coming, and I saw you coming, but they were right below me, and I couldn't do anything,
he choked, pulling me close.
My God, Alina, I'm so sorry. We can't do this anymore. It's too risky. It was so stupid of me to...
My parents know,
I blurted, and he braced himself as if he was about to sprint away.
Wait, they know, but they want to help you.
Help me?
He repeated. He seemed incredulous at this, as if I'd suggested something completely absurd, and that broke my heart just a little more.
I told you they had food somewhere. There is another cellar. The hatch is under the rug beneath the table in our house. They said you can hide there.
Tomas blinked, then he caught my shoulders in his palms.
Alina, he said flatly. This is very kind of your parents and very kind of you, but I can't accept that offer.
But why not? I asked desperately. It's not safe out here, Tomas. I'm so scared for you.
By the time I'd finished speaking, I was sobbing, and he pulled me hard against his torso again.
They would kill you if they found me there, and I can't.
He choked against my hair.
It's selfish enough for me to see you like this. But I thought they'd only link us if they caught us together. But if you hide me in your house...
That is not your concern, I said.
You are my concern.
If that is true, then you will grant me one small mercy and let us help you in this way. My parents have been trying to figure out how to get the food to those who need it. So perhaps you are the answer to their prayers.
When he remained stiff within my arms, I added softly,
Tomas, can you imagine how much help that food will be to this young family you are caring for? And there are others too, others in hiding. Mama has a whole sack of potatoes.
Can you just give me the food, Moya Fistko? He pleaded. I'll get it to those who need it. I don't have to stay in your home where the Nazis might find me. If I were to do as you ask, I'd have to come to and leave your house at least once a day. It's far too dangerous.
I rocked back on my heels and crossed my arms over my chest. Remember when you said I was spoiled, Tomas?
I do.
Well, I am accustomed to getting my own way, I said flatly. And I am not above blackmailing you when I know it's for your own good. So you will come stay with us, or I will find another way to get the food to those who need it.
He stared at me impassively, so I raised my eyebrows and added slowly,
Maybe I can visit Nadia Novak. Perhaps she has some ideas how I could distribute this food myself.
His eyes widened.
Alina Tsiak, he said incredulously. That is
the deal. I shrugged. Take it or leave it.
You leave me no choice.
That's exactly what I was intending, I said.
He shook his head at me, clearly frustrated.
I have more tricks up my sleeve, Tomas. Don't make me use them.
What are these tricks?
He asked, frowning harder now. I leaned forward and brushed my lips against his.
I will save them for the next time you underestimate me, I said softly. Then I brushed the hair back from his eyes.
He was still frowning at me, so I kissed him again, then turned away to return to the house, calling softly over my shoulder.
Come once it's dark. We'll be ready for you.
Chapter 18 Alice. I go through the motions at home. Wade is working late, making up for lost time for yesterday. He has some plastics project on that's been causing him grief, so I'm not surprised. As soon as the kids are in bed, I pour myself a glass of wine, put some music on, and sink into the sofa. Alice, plane, Poland. It's an absurd request, completely unreasonable, totally impractical. I just have no idea how I can ever decline it. If Babcia asked for the moon right now, I'd have to try to find a way to get it for her. And I think all she's asking me to do is get on a plane, take some photos, and come home. How quickly could I go? How quickly could I come back? I don't even know where Trebinia is. All I really know about the geography of Poland is that it's in Europe, and Warsaw is the capital. I could look it all up on Wade's laptop. It's just within my reach, resting on the coffee table in front of me. I don't reach for it. Instead, I listen to the music, and I wait until I hear Wade pulling into the garage. We haven't spoken a word to each other since the argument last night, but even so, I know he's going to bring flowers home with him tonight, and he'll be desperate to earn my forgiveness. Right on cue, he walks into the house carrying a bouquet of long-stemmed red roses and wearing a contrite expression. I set the wine glass next to the laptop as I stand, take the roses, and accept the kiss he offers. I'm sorry. He whispers. Me too, I whisper back. How are the kids? How is Babcia? How are you doing? Wade asks. Why don't you go get your dinner and I'll fill you in while you eat? Even if I wanted to go, it would be impossible. Tonight, Wade has been listening in silence while I talk, and it kind of reminds me of our earlier years, when I was the chatty one and he was the calm, scientific one. It used to astound me that someone so brilliant seemed to have endless interest in whatever I had to say. In the early months of our relationship, we talked until the sunrise more than once, and I never felt so important before. We are a long way from that place these days, but for a moment, it actually feels nice to remember that's the kind of people we used to be together, almost like we've taken a brief vacation back to a special place we used to visit. Wade's gaze is expressionless as he asks, "Do you want to go?" "It doesn't matter what I want," I say stiffly. "How could I possibly leave the kids?" He's back in my good graces well and truly after listening to me prattle on and on about this for the last 45 minutes. But in one fell swoop, he's right back into my bad books. "Jesus, Alice," Wade says. His exasperation is immediately on full display. "Give me at least a little credit. I have a PhD, for God's sake. I can handle a few days on my own with two kids." Red rage rushes in at me, so vivid and sudden that I can't actually see past it. I'm a boiling, seething pile of fury, and I have no idea what I'm supposed to do with all of this anger, so I just stare at him, my jaw hanging loose. "Really?" I say when my rage fades enough that I can bring myself to speak again. "It's as simple as that, is it?" "Yes, it is that simple," my husband says flatly. He leans back in the chair and crosses his arms over his chest. "I'm not saying I'd do everything your way, but we'd get by." It's my turn to lean back in my chair, and I exactly mirror his stance, crossing my arms over my chest and jutting my chin up a little. "And what would that look like, Wade? What would you do with Eddie, for example?" I've broken the unspoken rule of our family life. One does not draw attention to the elephant in the room. Wade's lack of a relationship with Eddie is a ghostly specter we can all see, but we never directly address. The flush on my husband's cheeks suggests he's embarrassed by the question, but the impatience doesn't fade from his glare. "He'd go to school, like a normal kid." "He can't handle full-time school, Wade," I say pointedly. "Even his teachers agree." "Well, he'd deal with it for 1 week. Maybe it's time we push him a bit more." "Push him a bit more?" I repeat the words blankly, but I can feel my eyebrows drawing down as my face shifts into a derisive scowl. "Yes, Alice," Wade says impatiently. He pauses, then he says carefully, "It's just that sometimes, maybe, you coddle him a little." "Coddle him?" I gasp. And that's it. I am done. I slam my hands onto the table, ready to stand, but we've been married for 10 years. Wade really does know me too well. "Don't you dare storm off," he groans. "You asked what I'd do, and I'm telling you. You have no right to cut me off just because you don't like my answer." "Do you have any idea how difficult it would be for Eddie if you just threw him into full-time school without planning or explanation?" "Maybe if you give the kid a chance, he could surprise you." "What is that supposed to mean?" "It means that you were convinced something was seriously wrong with Eddie from the time he was a baby, and you've never given him a chance to prove you wrong." "Oh, sure, Wade. This is all me, isn't it? The doctors and teachers and therapists are all wrong."
"I'm not saying he's a typical kid. He's clearly autistic, Alice. I'm not blind. I just think that maybe—"
Wade starts out fiercely, but then the sound of that harsh tone echoing all around our kitchen must have bounced back into his ears, because he winces and he pauses. When he speaks again, he pulls the aggression right back until he's speaking almost too gently.
"I'm scared we underestimate him, honey. That's all. I'm just saying that maybe if you spend as much time challenging him as you do protecting him, maybe your life would look different. And if you just loosen the goddamn reins for just a little bit, then maybe I could—"
I stand so fast and so hard that I tip the chair over and it crashes to the tiles. The sound is loud and it echoes all around us. Wade falls silent, but his determination to hold the line is evident. This argument is overdue. Maybe by weeks, maybe by years. Apparently, we've both been looking for a reason to dump our cards on the table, and that time has now arrived. I don't want to fight with him. I don't want to hurt him. But I have to make him understand, and the only way I can do that is to be honest. "You couldn't cope, Wade," I blurt. He raises his eyebrows at me.
"Are you kidding me? I'm responsible for 300 people at work, Alice. I can deal with our kids for a few days. Christ, it would be a fucking holiday."
There's an odd sensation within my chest, the splintering and shattering of something precious that had been straining under pressure for years. truths unspoken are falling out all over the place today, and it turns out there is a straw that's just too heavy for this old camel to carry. I spin on my heel and walk toward the family room. I slam the door behind me, and then I return to my armchair. I down the last of my wine in one gulp, then I reach for the laptop. I open the photo I snapped of Babcia's notes, and I start rapid-fire Googling. It takes about 2 minutes to confirm some of the entries are addresses, and Google maps them easily, so I take that as some kind of cosmic confirmation, and it amplifies my determination to help her. Next, I search for the names. I get a lot of pages, mostly social media pages for young people with the same arrangement of names. But then I find a Wikipedia page for Henry Adamkiewicz. Henry Adamkiewicz, 1890 to 1944, was an American photographer known for his coverage of Nazi-occupied countries during World War II. He was part of an early but unsuccessful effort to alert American and British governments about increasing Nazi brutality toward the Polish Jewish population, working with the Zagoda Council to arrange for couriers to smuggle film and documentation out of occupied Poland. He was executed by Nazi forces during the Warsaw Uprising in 1944. I Google frantically, looking at maps and Google Translate and the calendar. I learned that I can fly into Krakow and be at Babcia's childhood town within an hour. I need a few days to prepare, and then I need to be back within a week, so I decide to stay for 4 nights. Last-minute flights are expensive, obscenely so, and at last, that gives me pause. I'm being impulsive, and despite what my mother sometimes implies, I don't do impulsive. The things she sees as impulsive in my history reflect my lack of courage, not impulsiveness. All of the times when I didn't dare warn her in advance that I wanted so desperately to take a different path to the one she'd chosen for me.
I can deal with our kids for a few days. Christ, it would be a fucking holiday.
The door flies open and Wade storms in after me.
What are you doing? He asks, staring at the computer on my lap.
I look up at him calmly. You can handle our kids for a few days, remember? It will be a holiday.
Alice, come on. I can't take time off quickly. You know that, he says impatiently,
patronizing me, condescending, as if I'm a silly child instead of the woman who holds his entire world together, which is exactly what I am. I'll tell Babcia not to die until it suits your work schedule, I say bitterly, and then I select the tickets.
Alice, what are you doing?
I hear the sudden anxiety in Wade's tone. He can't see the screen, but he can see the expression on my face, and something there is making him very nervous. Well, so it should. I let the browser pre-fill the credit card, and then before I lose courage, I jab my finger against the mouse to activate the purchase button. Please do not press the back button on your browser. This may take up to a minute. For a split second, I feel triumph, but then it hits me what I've done, and I feel my heart rate zoom all the way up until adrenaline floods my system, and I can barely force myself to breathe. I look up at Wade in a panic, and for the first time, he panics too.
Allie, he says,
then he rushes around the coffee table to stare down at the laptop screen.
Honey, what did you do?
I do the sensible thing then, and I think about how much money I just wasted on flights and how impossible it all is, and I burst into tears. Wade takes the laptop from me just as it gives the ding to indicate the purchase has been successful. He's silent as he reads the payment receipt that's now loaded on my screen. I glance up at him, and I see the tightening in his jaw and the way his nostrils flare. He doesn't look at me, not for the longest time.
Alice,
he finally starts to say, but I hold up my hand toward him abruptly.
Don't, I say. Don't, just don't.
I'll give you some time to cool off, he sighs,
and he drops the laptop onto the lounge without further ceremony. It bounces against the leather, then comes to a stop near the edge. Neither one of us reaches for it, like we're scared to touch it in case it poisons us. Wade turns and walks toward the door, but just before he leaves the room, he throws a final missive over his shoulder.
But we need to talk about this tonight.
Chapter 19. Alice. Wade retreats to his study, but when I walk past the closed door, I can hear the rhythmic clicking of the keys on his electronic keyboard. When he is stressed or pondering some complex problem, he does one of two things.
He runs miles and miles, or he puts his headphones on and he sits at the keyboard and he tries to learn impossibly difficult piano concertos. A habit that's lingered from his childhood when his mother correctly predicted that a boy so enamored with math would enjoy the challenge and symmetry of musicianship. In the weeks after Eddie's diagnosis, Wade worked on Rachmaninoff's third until he gave himself a nasty case of repetitive strain injury in both hands. He says distracting the conscious part of his brain with some other kind of work helps him to process things. I've long suspected that Wade suffers from the exact same challenge we have with Callie. His brain runs too fast, and unless he occupies himself with something really intense, he tends to work himself into knots. And that's kind of the opposite to my coping mechanism, because I'm upset too, so I run a bath. Tonight, I take the time to light several of the candles, the rose-scented ones, because they remind me of Babcia's beautiful rose garden at her old house. I dump the whole bottle of bubble mixture into the water, and the foamy bubbles on top rise until they spill over onto the flat edge of the tiles around the bath. But I don't even care. I sink into the water, and I cry some more because I'm completely confused about what to do next. This should be simple. I should call the airline and cancel the tickets. I'm just not sure that's what I actually want to do. There's a battle raging inside me. Exactly 50% of me is cheering and desperate to go on this crazy quest, but the rest of me is every bit as desperate to stay home. I stay in the bath far too long. The bubbles slowly pop. The water cools. I refill the tub with hot water several times and my skin wrinkles, but I still don't move. When the door opens quietly, it's just after midnight, and I'm still sitting here in the bath, still crying on and off. The candles have burned down, and even though they are long finished now, their scent and the smell of the wax linger too heavily, leaving a sickly, sweet smell in the air. Wade enters the room gently, as if he's expecting me to be asleep, and he's afraid to wake me. But then he knocks the toilet lid down and he sits heavily upon it.
You really want to do this, he says. It's a statement, not a question. But I seriously wish this were that simple. I look up at him through bleary eyes.
I don't know. I know it's too much to ask. I know it's going to be too hard for the family, but I feel like I should do it.
Allie, Wade sighs. I don't know how we got here. Do you?
I hate it when I can't keep up with him in a conversation, and this one has only just started, but I already have no idea what he's talking about. I scan around the bathroom, then back to him blankly. Here?
Remember back at the beginning? We talked about everything. Once upon a time, you'd call me because you read an article in a newspaper that interested you, or you saw something unusual on your way home from the store, and I loved that about you.
A desperate sadness creeps into his expression, and he exhales, then adds,
I loved that about us. Now you book tickets to Europe without telling me. We live in the same house, but I have no clue what's going on inside your head. Are you even happy? Do you?
His voice breaks, and he stops for a moment before he asks me in a whisper,
Alice, do you still love me?
There's a moment of painful silence. We stare at each other, close enough almost to touch, despite the ocean of distance between us. Eddie, I say. That single word is rough with years of withheld emotion. Wade swallows and looks away, down to the gleaming white tiles on the floor. Eddie changed everything. Just as there's a curtain of chaos between Eddie and the world, there's now a curtain of chaos between Wade and I, because my world revolves around my son, and my husband hasn't found a way to connect with him at all. I hate that even on the best of days, but right now as I stare up at Wade, I wonder for the very first time if he hates it too. It's been easy to assume that Wade's failure to connect with Eddie was a purposeful form of sulking. The world hasn't given him the son he wants, so he refuses to acknowledge the son he has. If I force my emotions aside and make myself be completely rational here, that kind of behavior is just not in Wade's nature. It's more comforting to tell myself that Wade is at fault here, because the alternative is that Wade doesn't know how to connect with Eddie, or that he's too scared to try.
I found a tour guide, Wade says,
in another abrupt change of subject that leaves me feeling lost all over again. I wave vaguely toward the towels, and he hands me one, then watches silently as I step out of the bath. Once the towel is wrapped tightly around me, I glance at him again. A guide who can visit those places for Babcia? It makes perfect sense. We can cancel the insanely expensive airline tickets and pay someone who is already in the country to go take some photos for Babcia. I can't quite understand why I feel so disappointed at the solution Wade has found, given it actually solves every single one of my problems. No. He frowns, then gives me that haughty look, the one I hate so much, the one he gets sometimes when he's busy being brilliant and I'm just not keeping up. Someone who can take you to those places, Allie. She's fluent in English and Polish. She has a master's degree in modern history, and she's a licensed tour guide. Her name is Zofia. I've just been on the phone with her, and she sounds perfect. She does family history stuff all the time. She said family and war history tours make up most of her business, actually. But she's normally booked out months in advance, and she's only free because she had a cancellation next week. So I booked her on the spot. She'll take you to the town and help you see the things Babcia wants to see. She said the 3 days you've booked should be plenty of time to visit the town and take a good look around. It's a pretty small place.
You what? But
the town is Trevinia, right?
I stare at him in disbelief. How could you even know that?
You left the tabs open on the laptop.
He shrugs, then his gaze meets mine again.
You can email her and do some planning, but the gist of it is you fly out Monday night, so you arrive in Krakow on the Tuesday. She's booking a hotel for you, and she'll meet you there Wednesday morning and take it from there.
I panicked when I booked the tickets, but that was a blistering act of rage, and it was something I was half intending to undo. This panic is different. It feels a little bit more like fear, because I have a sneaking suspicion I'm about to find myself well and truly out of my depth. I pinch the bridge of my nose and try to take some deep breaths, because I have no idea whether I should yell at Wade for babying me or thank him for helping me. I look up at him suddenly as I try to decide how to react, but my chest constricts when I see how he's sitting. His shoulders have slumped, and he's staring at the sudsy tiles on the floor, utter misery in his gaze. He feels my eyes on him, though, and he raises his chin to look back at me. As our eyes lock, I feel so many things. Sadness, that things between us feel so broken. Confusion, because I still don't know how to react to his intervention here. And love. Love, maybe most of all. The man has broken my heart more times than I can count in the last few years, and he's let me down, and he's let our son down. But at the end of the day, the love I have for him hasn't waned even a little bit, and I am furious with myself that he's ever had cause to think otherwise.
You know, for months, maybe even years, I've been trying to figure out how to make it all better, he says heavily.
Weariness crosses his face, even as he shifts to avoid my gaze again.
I have everything I ever wanted in life. You, this house, my job, this family, for the most part. But every day it feels like you slip a little further away from me, and you're the key to it all. If I lose you, Alice, the rest of it goes too.
There's a rawness in this declaration that takes my breath away. Wade reaches for my hand, and he holds it against his cheek, then closes his eyes. I stare down at him, sitting there so vulnerable, and, well, sitting on our toilet seat, of all of the places in the world we could have had this conversation. It turns out I do have some tears left after all, because I see my handsome, brilliant husband so desperate at last.